Nothing but grief for her out there, without me to protect her. Say it, Clex Ponch, Susan asked softly, through lowered lashes. Tell me you're not ticked at me.
I'm not sore, Poncho said truthfully. I'm worried, though. You'll be all alone out there, with 10,000 others, without your big sister.
Susan said nothing for a heartbeat. Then she reached across the coffee table and grasped Poncho's hand. But, Ponch, don't you see? That's why I'm doing it. That's why I've got to do it. I've got to go out on my own. I can't live like some little kid with you doing everything for me. I've got to be free.
Sagging back into the softly yielding sofa, Poncho murmured, Yeah, I suppose you do. I guess I knew it all along.
It's just that I worry about you, Susie. I'll be fine, Ponch. You'll see.
I sure hope so.
Elated, Susan hopped to her feet and headed for the door. You'll see, she repeated. It's going to be great. Cosmic.
Poncho sighed and got to her feet.
Oh, by the way, Susan called over her shoulder as she opened the office door. I'm changing my name. I'm not going to be called Susan anymore. From now on, my name is Holly.
And she ducked through the door before Poncho could say a word more.
Holly,
Poncho muttered to the closed door. Where in the ever-loving blue-eyed world did she get that from? She wondered.
Why she want to change her name?
Shaking her head, Poncho told the phone to connect with her security chief. When his handsome square-jawed face took shape in the air above her desk, she said, Wendell, I need somebody to ride that goddamned habitat out to Saturn and keep tabs on my sister, without her knowing it.
Right away, the security chief answered.
He looked away for a moment and then said, about tonight, I...
Never mind about tonight, Poncho snapped.
You just get somebody onto that habitat. Somebody good. Get on it right now.
Yes, ma'am, said Poncho's security chief.
Lunar Orbit, Habitat Goddard. Malcolm Eberly tried to hide the panic that was still frothing like a storm-tossed sea inside him. Along with the 15 other department leaders, he stood perfectly still at the main entrance to the habitat. The ride up from Earth had been an agony for him. From the instant the clipper ship had gone into Earth orbit and the feeling of gravity had dwindled to zero, Eberly had fought a death struggle against the terror of weightlessness. Strapped into his well-cushioned seat, he had exerted every effort of his willpower to fight back the horrible urge to vomit. I will not give in to this, he told himself through gritted teeth. Pale and soaked with cold sweat, he resolved that he would not make a fool of himself in front of the others. Getting out of his seat once the clipper ship had made rendezvous with the transfer rocket was sheer torture. Eberly kept his head rigidly unmoving, his fists clenched, his eyes squeezed down to slits. To the cheerful commands of the flight attendants, he followed the bobbing gray coveralls of the woman ahead of him and made his way along the aisle hand over hand from one seat back to the next until he glided through the hatch into the transfer vehicle, still in zero gravity, gagging as his insides floated up into his throat. No one else seemed to be as ill as he. The rest of them, 15 other men and women, all department leaders as he was, were chatting and laughing, even experimenting with allowing themselves to float up off the Velcro carpeting of the passenger compartment. The sight of it made Eberly's stomach turn inside out. Still, he held back the bile that was burning his throat. I will not give in to this, he told himself over and over. I will prevail. A man can accomplish anything he sets his mind to if he has the strength and the will. Strapped down again in a seat inside the transfer rocket, he stared rigidly ahead as the ship lit off its engines to start its flight to lunar orbit. The thrust was gentle, but at least it provided some feeling of weight. Only for a few seconds, though. The rocket engines cut off, and he felt again as if he were falling, endlessly falling. Everyone else was chattering away, several of them boasting about how many times they had been in space. Of course, Eberly realized, they've all done this before. They've experienced this wretchedness before, and now it doesn't bother them. They're all from wealthy families, rich, spoiled children who've never had a care in their lives. I'm the only one here who's never been off the earth before, the only one who's had to fight and claw for a living, the only one who's known hunger and sickness and fear. I've got to make good here. I've got to. Otherwise, they'll send me back. I'll die in a filthy prison cell. Through sheer mental exertion, Eberle endured the hours of weightlessness. When the woman in the seat next to him tried to engage him in conversation, he replied tersely to her inane remarks, desperately fighting to keep her from seeing how sick he was. He forced a smile, hoping that she would not notice the cold sweat beating his upper lip. He could feel it soaking the cheap, thin shirt he wore. After a while, she stopped her chattering and turned her attention to the display screen built into the seat backs. Eberle concentrated on the images, too. The screen showed the habitat, an ungainly cylinder hanging in the emptiness of space like a length of sewer pipe left behind by a vanished construction crew. As they approached it, though, the habitat grew bigger and bigger. Eberle could see that it was rotating slowly. He knew that the spin created a feeling of gravity inside the cylinder. Numbers ran through his mind. The habitat was 20 kilometers in length, 4 kilometers across. It rotated every 45 seconds, which produced a centrifugal force equivalent to normal Earth gravity. In his growing excitement, he almost forgot the unease of his stomach. Now he could see the long windows running the length of the gigantic cylinder. And the moon came into view, shining brightly. But seen this close, the moon was ugly, scarred and pitted with countless craters. One of the biggest of them, Eberle knew, housed the city-state of Selene. Swiftly, the habitat grew to blot out everything else. For a moment, Eberle feared they would crash into it, even though his rational mind told him that the ship's pilots had their flight under precise control. He could see the solar mirrors hugging the cylinder's curving sides, and bulbs and knobs dotting the habitat's skin like bumps on a cucumber. Some of them were observation blisters, he knew. Others were docking ports, thruster pods, airlocks. "This is your captain speaking," said a woman's voice from the speakers set above each display screen. "We have gone into a rendezvous orbit around the habitat. In 3 minutes, we will be docking. You'll feel a bump or two. Nothing to be alarmed about." The thump jarred all the passengers. Eberle gripped his seat arms tightly and waited for more. But nothing else happened. Except his innards had settled down. He no longer felt sick. Gravity had returned, and he felt normal again. No, better than normal. He turned to the woman sitting beside him and studied her face briefly. It was a round, almost chubby face with large, dark, almond eyes and curly black hair. Her skin was smooth, young, but swarthy. Eberle judged she was of Mediterranean descent, Greek or Spanish or perhaps Italian. He smiled broadly at her. "Here we've been sitting next to each other for more than 6 hours, and I haven't even told you my name. I'm Malcolm Eberle." She smiled back. "Yes, I can see." Tapping the name badge pinned to her blouse, she said, "I'm Andrea Marinella. I'm with the Agrotech team." A farmer, Eberle thought. A stupid, grubbing farmer. But he smiled still wider and replied, "I'm in charge of the Human Resources Department." "How nice." Before he could say more, the flight attendant asked them all to get up and head for the hatch. Eberle unstrapped and got to his feet, happy to feel solid weight again, eager to get his first glimpse of the habitat. The inner terror he had fought against dwindled almost to nothing. "I won," he exulted to himself. "I faced the terror, and I beat it." He politely allowed Marinella to slide out into the aisle ahead of him and then followed her to the hatch. The 16 men and women filed through the hatch into an austere metal-walled chamber. An older man stood by the inner hatch, tall and heavy-set. His thick head of hair was iron-gray, and he had a bushy gray mustache. His face looked rugged, weather-beaten, the corners of his eyes creased by squinting in the open sun. He wore a comfortable suede pullover and rumpled tan jeans. Two younger men stood slightly behind him, clad in coveralls, obviously under